Okay, thank you. Thanks for the introduction. So, I will talk about how the notion of quantum error correction may emerge in this holographic scattering or holographic task paradigm. So, here's roughly the plan of my talk. I will briefly revisit the error correction interpretation of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And then I will do a very brief recap of the Alex's work. Well, he has already reviewed it, so this one will be very brief. Then I want to introduce a certain multiple input protocol based on entanglement-assisted quantum error corrections, and then give some discussions. Okay, so let's get started. So ADS-CFT correspondence. As you have already learned, ADS-CFT correspondence is a conjecture which says that some quantum gravity theory living on the bulk of the ADS spacetime is dual to the boundary conformal field theory living on the boundary. The point is that here this system has no gravity, but this system has gravity. So the system without gravity is less mysterious, so we have a good handle of this, so we can study this gravity object reliably by using these quantum mechanical tools. But for the mind of a quantum information theorist, it's convenient to imagine a bunch of qubits, right? I mean, so on the gravity side, in this picture, you can imagine like qubits are living on the ADS space, and then these qubits are interacting with each other, but they are sitting on this negatively curved spacetime. On the other hand, we have a quantum mechanical system. In this example, it's a one-dimensional spin chain. Then they are interacting with each other, and then, well, they need to be interacting in a special manner, realizing some special conformal field theory. But the point is that whatever happening here, this physics of 2D qubits can be encoded into this one-dimensional bunch of qubits. So that's essentially what it means by ADS-CFT correspondence. Now, the reason why this idea became very popular recently is because of the Ryo Takanagi formula, where they first proposed that if you want to compute the entanglement entropy for this subregion A, then all you have to do is to find the minimal geodetic length. So this is a blue line. And then you have some proportionality constant. 1 over g Newton, but this is a very, very big number. So this formula successfully, of course, reproduces the known result in conformal field theory, which essentially says that the entropy is proportional to log of A size. But I think the more interesting aspect of this formula is that if you have multiple boundary regions like A1 and A2, then you always need to look for the minimal path. So this dotted line is not the minimal path, and this solid line is the one. And so this is the Ryo Takanagi formula. Okay, so then I just want to mention, yeah, so this Ryo Takanagi formula has been sort of derived, and it has been tested in many contexts. And of course, nice thing about this formula is that on the left-hand side, you have a quantum mechanical quantity, that's entropy. On the right-hand side, it's just length, so it's just purely geometric quantity. So it seems like gravity is emerging from quantum. But this RT formula has a sort of a generalized version, which I think tells us and teaches us more. That is roughly called the entanglement wedge reconstruction. So I'm gonna just try to explain it in a bit like simple way. So here, this is a correspondence about operators. So imagine that we have some bulk operator phi. I'm using phi to represent like phi field and bulk, but this can be anything. And in the qubit example, you can imagine Pauli X operator or Pauli Z operator. And then, so we consider some operator that acts on this degree of freedom sitting on this bulk point. And then we ask what are the corresponding operators on the boundary, which essentially does the same thing as this phi operator. Then this entanglement wedge reconstruction is a hypothesis which says that if this phi is contained in the so-called entanglement wedge of this subregion A, then there exists this OA operator that corresponds to this phi operator. So more precisely, it means is like you can think about two situations. So first, you apply this phi operator on the bulk, then you create some state. On the boundary, you hit this state with OA. And then the statement, the claim is that they do the same thing. And you can find such operator OA in this localized region instead of the whole region. So this is the entanglement wedge reconstruction. And again, this becomes more and more interesting if you have an operator and then there are multiple intervals. Then in this case, phi is inside the entanglement wedge of A1 and A2. Therefore, we should be able to write down a corresponding operator on the boundary that should look like OA1, A2. Now, this claim has been sort of proven by using sort of a generalized version of the Ryu-Takanagi formula. But this proof is a bit of a black box proof. And to the best of my knowledge, no explicit recipe of writing down this OA operator, especially when there are more than one intervals. These things are currently not known. But there is a sort of a black box proof. OK. But this entanglement wedge reconstruction conjecture ran into some puzzle. So let me explain this puzzle. It's often called a bulk locality puzzle, but the puzzle is very simple. So let's think about the following situation, just like ADS space is just a disk. And then we are going to split the boundary region into A and B and C, so three subsystems. Then we are going to look at the operator sitting at the center of the bulk here. Then we notice that this bulk operator is contained in the entanglement wedge of BC. So this means that this operator has a corresponding expression on OBC, like BC. But I can repeat the same argument and saying like there should be a corresponding operator on AB, and that's on AC. Then this is a bit strange because it sounds like this phi operator corresponds to an operator on the boundary, which is supported on BC, supported on AB, supported on AC. But there is no such operator, right? So this seems to suggest naively that this bulk operator must correspond to identity operator on the boundary. But if this is an identity operator, then it's a bit strange. I mean, identity operator doesn't do anything interesting. So that was the puzzle. But this puzzle can be resolved by using the notion of quantum error correcting code. The idea is maybe the ADS CFT correspondence is actually a quantum error correcting code. And indeed, this situation is a particular realization of quantum error correction. So what was wrong in the previous argument is that we assume that there is a unique corresponding boundary operator. But instead, maybe there are different boundary operator like OBC, OAB, OCA. They are all different. But they may act in the same manner if we restrict our attention to some, people call it the low energy subspace. But I think in the language of quantum information, this is just a code word subspace. That is, in the whole Hilbert space, these three operators are obviously different because they are just simply different. But you restrict your attention to some subspace, then they may act in the same way, and then there is no contradiction. So the claim is that maybe these three partition things is a realization of a quantum error correction. But this kind of quantum error correction is already known, and it's very famous. It's called a quantum secret sharing code. Imagine, so that is like Alice and Bob and Charlie is sharing a quantum secret. But even if Alice leaves the collaboration, still Bob and Charlie can come together and then reconstruct this quantum state. So this encoding is protected against erasure of any one of the subsystems. So this is how the quantum error correction emerges in the ADS CFT correspondence. And this kind of physics actually appear in various aspects of the physics of quantum gravity even beyond the ADS CFT correspondence. But motivated by this interpretation, we have constructed a larger network of quantum error collecting code based on the tensor network. And here is the drawing. So the idea was that we use the very entangled quantum tensors, such as like Hall random tensors. And then, so this Hall random tensor has six tensor legs. I leave one of them open, this red dot. This corresponds to the qubits living on the bulk space. And then this bulk qubit is entangled to the system, like space, through these tensors. Then we just connect these bulk tensor legs, and then you have this object. Now, what this object does is like you have a bunch of input qubits on the bulk, and then there is an output on the boundary. So this defines a quantum error correcting code where you can specify the bulk state, like zero state, one state, or anything, and then you have some output on the boundary. And then it turns out that this simple trick of using random tensors works very nicely, and it worked beyond my initial expectation. So the for example, the Ryu-Takanagi formula, or even like a generalized version of the Ryu-Takanagi formula, follows very naturally, and the entanglement wedge reconstruction follows, and so on. So it's still a bit mysterious why this kind of toy model works nicely, but somehow it works, and it reproduces many of the salient features of ADS-CFT correspondence. But important thing I want to emphasize through this quantum error correction interpretation is that so let's imagine again like bulk center, like qubits sitting at the center of the bulk. Let's say we can think of power x or power z or power y operator here, for instance. Then because I'm using these random tensors here, so you can, roughly speaking, you can sort of push this operator toward the boundary, and then that will be your logical operator of this quantum error correcting code. But the point is that by using these Hall random tensors, it has to be the case that the expression of the logical operator on the boundary tends to be very, very complicated. Namely, it cannot be implemented usually by a short depth quantum circuit. So we usually tend to say like we go to the center of the bulk and then say hi to each other and perform B84 protocol or whatever, teleportation and so on. But these are very simple operations in this bulk center language. But these operations, if you translate it back to the boundary, this can be something very, very complicated and maybe cannot be done very easily. So that is one thing we should keep in mind.
So I'm a little confused about talking about a completely random tensor and why that's relevant when you're talking about some specific operation like the BU84.
Right. Oh, so what I want to emphasize here is that we can think about, well, like we don't need to think about BU84, but we can just say like some quantum state fall into this center of the bulk, and then let's say, well, it does something like it says it flips his own spin or anything, like any unitary operator acting on this qubits sitting at the center of the bulk. If we believe, to some extent, if we even like qualitatively believe this kind of toy model, then changing the quantum state here corresponds to applying a logical operator on this quantum error correcting code. But in order to apply that logical operator on the boundary, that expression is usually very complicated, and usually it cannot be written by a short depth quantum circuit, like short depth one. So it takes time to.
Yeah. Harry, did you have
Yeah, I was also about this random tensor, but the point that you cannot do this short low-depth computation on the boundary is not because it's a random tensor, but because it's an error correcting code.
So that I will comment on that later. But there are multiple reasons why this operator at the center of the bulk should be complicated on the boundary. So I will mention that later again. But
how big is this tensor?
It's just a tiling of the area space, and roughly speaking, this tensor bond should correspond to the 1 over g Newton thing, so that's a very big tensors. But I think the point here is that if this logical operator on the boundary or corresponding operator is, suppose it's very simple, such as like a transversal logical operator, like a product one, then that would mean that by applying some quantum operation on the boundary in order one time, I would be able to apply unitary operator on the bulk, at the center of the bulk. But this would contradict with the causality of this space-time, because by doing something here on the boundary, I shouldn't be able to send a signal in the order one time to the center of the bulk. So this means that this expression of the logical operator must be very complicated.
But shouldn't it be at least as complicated as simulating this random tensor?
Yes. So its depth will be essentially, so this encoding circuit gives us a concrete recipe of how to write down the logical operator. So it should be as complicated as this quantum circuit.
Question? Richard? So sorry for the naive question, but where should we think of the boundary as being located in space? Like how often infinity or?
Yeah, so formally speaking, we should think about infinity, and then there is, of course, a subtlety of how to take the infinity and so on. But for our purpose, I think it's actually just safe to say that we just put the finite cutoff from the asymptotic infinity and then place qubits there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I think this has an important lesson that we casually go to the center of the bulk or casually go near the black hole, and we tend to do some photo experiment involving black holes. But this simple thing you do here or here and here, it could be very, very complicated on the boundary. I mean, very, very means like it's just, well, this is the, in some sense, this is the circuit. But the point is that this cannot be done instantaneously. Well, that is, I think, one of the things we can deduce. Anyway, so this is about the quantum error correction interpretation of the ADS CFD correspondence. Now let me go back to the scattering problem. So I think I can be very quick on this slide, but the problem was that you have two input states, C1 and C2, and they will meet here and they interact with each other in a way they want. And then R1 and R2 are output points. So there is a direct interactions, direct talking was possible on the bulk. But on the boundary, there was not enough time for these input particles to meet and then scatter. Especially like this C1, C2 cannot scatter to R1, R2. So then this would mean that the particles in ADS CFD correspondence must be non-interacting, but that would be strange. But then, so in order to make this intuition more precise, we should actually look at the future and the past light cones and so on, and then you can actually see that there is indeed no boundary direct scattering region. But, this is just for formality. But anyway, the beautiful resolution of which Alex came up with is that maybe it's actually the case that C1 and C2 do not interact with each other in a direct manner, but they are maybe interacting with each other in an indirect manner by using quantum entanglement as a resource. Specifically, he has considered these very important regions, W1 and W2. These are like wedges. So what is these wedges? And so this W1 is in the future of the input point. So input points can have access to this red shaded area. But this region is still possible to send signals to output point R1 and R2. So in this sense, we can think that this W1 is like a region of the spacetime where this C1 can, in principle, have an access and utilize. Then you can define similar region, W2. And then, but nice thing about this idea is that if you look at this W1, W2 region in this kind of figure, then you notice that their wedges are connected in a sense that if you use the Ryotakari formula, these red lines are the shortest path. And then this is indeed characteristics of the cases where these W1, W2 share large amount of a quantum entanglement. And by large, I mean that it is 1 over J Newton, but this is like super big. So in principle, C1 and C2 can have access to nice entanglement. So let's try to use it. So then here comes the non-local computation idea that is so this left-hand side figure, that there's a causal diagram for bulk, but on the boundary, it's like this. There is no direct scattering. But the point is that W1, W2 are entangled. So C1 may try to, let's say, teleport his state to C2 and then do something and then redistribute and then apply feedback and so on. So there are some interactions we can write down between C1 and C2. And as already explained, in principle, it is possible to induce any kind of unitary interactions between C1 and C2 by using port-based teleportation. And of course, this requires a lot of resources, but in principle, it's possible. So this beautiful idea seems to suggest that, yeah, we are fine. There is no puzzle in a sense that as long as we can utilize this entanglement, so interactions, it's fine. OK, that's a very beautiful resolution. But I would say that probably ADS-CFT correspondence is not really performing port-based teleportation in reality. So it should be doing something a little bit different because, well, it's just they are just jumping into the center of the ADS space and then rescattering, right? So such a simple process, looking at port-based teleportation, it's very different, probably. So I think the real important open problem right now, at least in the gravity side, is to understand really like how this interaction may emerge in the language of the conformal field theory. To put it in a more concrete setting, we can think like usually we will consider on the bulk theory, these qubits I mentioned are interacting with each other, but in a very simple interactions, it's usually we consider free theory. But we can start adding interactions, let's say for scalar field, FIFO terms can be added, for instance. And that would be the interactions among these two particles. And how does this correspond to the boundary language? Because somehow this conformal field theory should be utilizing quantum entanglement. And I think this question remains open. And personally, I think this is one of the most important problems I think gravity people should solve. But anyway, so this is the nice idea about the holographic task and so these stories. Now, I have talked about two things. So this non-local computation or entanglement ideas. And then I have also talked about quantum error correction in ADS-CFT correspondence. So naturally, I want to add both of them. And then so in a sense that I strongly believe that in the natural process of CFT, then when they are interacting with each other, and then the interactions should be emerging in the form of entanglement-assisted quantum error correcting code. So let me elaborate more on this point. Is it OK for now? Or? Okay, so let's start by revisiting this quantum error correction interpretations. So in this holographic task experiment, we often throw particles, well, photons or whatever, into the center of the bulk ADS space. But from the error correction viewpoint, at the center, when you reach at the center, this operator or this object is deeply encoded into the code word subspace of the quantum error correcting code. So at the beginning, this quantum state, let's say 0, 1, or 0 plus 1, these are just existing as bare qubits, very simple object. But when you send them into the center of the bulk, it has to be the case that these states needs to be encoded into a quantum error correcting code. So instead of 0 and 1, we should talk about logical 0 state and logical 1 state in the code word subspace. Then this means that changing the quantum state at the center of the bulk should be like changing the logical quantum state of a quantum error correcting code. But in order to change the encoded state, what we should do is to apply a logical operator in a quantum error correcting code. Now, with this viewpoint in mind, so now I'm drawing three input cases because I'm going to actually mostly focus on three input cases. But what should be happening in this holographic scattering experiment in reality would be like this. We initially have three input, psi 1, psi 2, psi 3. But we send it to the center of the bulk. But this sending, this act of sending, should be performing nice encoding into a quantum error correcting code. Okay. Then when they meet, they interact with each other. But this interaction among these three qubits should be happening as a form of logical operations, which couples these three logical qubits. Then they will rescatter again off to the boundary. And then it will be realized as a very localized, simple qubit. That act should be interpreted as a decoding of a quantum error correcting code. So we hope to sort of mimic this procedure. And then want to come up with a protocol where this kind of system does a non-local quantum computation by using this encoding, logical operation, and decoding. But with this in mind, it's actually like it's actually the way this works is like a quantum computer, in the sense that when we have a quantum, well, we don't have yet, but when we have a quantum computer, what we do is we usually encode a quantum state into a quantum error correcting code, and then we do quantum computations. And then, of course, this process may have some errors, but it's fine because later we can error correct and then decode the result. But this is really very similar to how a fault-tolerant quantum computer works. Anyway, yeah, I feel like this kind of talk, I should try to put the slogan. But, anyway, now let's return to the concrete problem. So the problem I want to focus today is a three-in, three-out scattering process. The reason why I want to go to three instead of two is that this three realizes this idea of quantum error correcting code most vividly, more than two-qubit cases. So the process we are thinking is that we have three input, one, two, three. Then they come together, and then at the center of the bulk, they will be able to interact with each other in any way they want. Then they can scatter off to the boundary. Now, let us look at this process from the boundary viewpoint. Then this time, we notice that it's actually two-in, two-out scattering is possible. You have still time to bring C2 and C3 together, and then scatter to R2 and R3. That is possible. But unfortunately, you can't bring three particles together and then scatter them to the boundary. That is not possible. So, but here again, it's convenient to draw this kind of a causality structure as a graph. And this time, the graph looks like this. C1, C2, C3 are input points. R1, R2, R3 are output points. But this time, because two scattering is possible, we have a sort of a intermediate point, which I call M1, M2, M3. So M3 is essentially the scattering region where C2 and C3 can be brought together and then scatter off to R2, A, and R3. Okay. So then similarly, M1, M2. So this is the causal diagram. And then our problem is to come up with a nice protocol to implement U123 on this kind of a causal graph. Okay. And then again, from the quantum error correction interpretation, I expect that the whole process should look like this. We have input C1, C2, C3, but then this input will be encoded. Then the intermediate steps, M1, M2, M3, probably C1, C2, C3 will be encoded into a quantum error correcting code. And then later we will decode it, and then it will be revealed at R1, R2, R3. And then probably interaction will be happening somewhere in this area. Right? So that is the picture I would imagine. Okay. What did I say? Yeah. So, but looking at this boundary causality graph, it's obvious that without the use of a quantum entanglement, you really cannot do this U123. So, what should we do? Now, this time we need to look at entanglement resource for three wedges. These three wedges I drew are something like this. So this wedge, let's say W2, is in the future of C2, but it's in the past of R1, R2, R3. Okay. So this is a region which C2 can utilize and send signal to all the future point. So that's a very good region. And so W1, W2, W3 are the regions. Then the question is, is there any nice resource shared among these W1, W2, and W3? Okay, then again, what we should do is to use the Ryota-Carnegie formula, looking for minimal geodesics and so on. Then we can easily find that, yes, this W1, W2, W3 indeed have some entanglement. Namely, if you compute the mutual information like W1 and W2, W3, then it will be large. Okay. Now, of course, mutual information, non-zero mutual information does not necessarily imply quantum entanglement. It could be classical correlation. But in this kind of situations, let's say if you use tensor network toy models, then it's very plausible to think that this kind of correlation mostly is coming from quantum entanglement. Okay, so there is some nice entanglement, let's say between 1 and 2, 3. That's nice. But if you compute W1, W2, the mutual information, then it turns out it's zero. This means that this three-party state has no bipartite entanglement. So all we have is just three-party entanglement. And then this is quite unfortunate news for us, especially because if we have a bunch of EPR pairs, then we can just use port-based teleportation, for instance, and send C1 to C2 and resend it to C3 and then do something and then redistribute and so on. So we can use port-based teleportation to do any arbitrary interactions if we have EPR pairs, but unfortunately we do not have any EPR pairs. So we really need to come up with some nice protocol to do that. And I guess, again, this is, I think, another reason why that in the interaction in the ADS-CFT correspondence should be happening in a way which is probably a bit different from the teleportation and the port-based teleportation type ideas. Okay. But still, we made a progress that is, we have causal graph and then we have resource state. And then they are somehow entangled with each other. But since there is no EP pairs, this problem looks a bit difficult. But there is actually a nice trick we can use. That is, as I have mentioned, W1 is entangled with W2 and W3. Okay. Now, unfortunately, of course, W1 is not entangled with W2 or W3. It's only with the total W2 and W3. But if we look at this M3 region, the intermediate region, then in principle, we can send this resource W2 and W3 to this M3 points. But this is nice because now W1 was entangled with W2, W3, which means that we should be able to distill entangled quantum state, let's say EPR pairs, for instance, between this W1 and some qubit on the M3 point. So instead of like entanglement in this time slice, we can consider entanglement in this kind of a wiggly slice. So that is, this is the present and this is a bit future, but you can think about entanglement between this point and this one. So the, our idea is to use this entanglement in the future, in the past. I mean, it's not in the strict future, it's in the space-like slice, so it's fine. But anyway, so by using this EPR pair between W1 and the M3, we can actually try to do something interesting. And then here comes the quantum error correction, especially entanglement-assisted quantum error correcting code. So the difficulty of this problem was that the initial state at, let's say, psi1, without using entanglement, it can send a signal to M1 and M2. So it's kind of localized in these two points. But because of this EPR pair between C1 and M3, now by mixing this input information with this EPR pair, you can actually delocalize this psi1 information over M1, M2, M3, sort of in a kind of a uniform manner. And on the right-hand side, I drew some concrete encoding circuit. It's just, you know, you have EPR pair, and then you mix the input state and then do this. Then it's actually known that this kind of idea is called entanglement-assisted quantum error correcting code. And if you choose this V12 nicely, it turns out that this initial information will be shared among these three parties in a way that you can actually deconstruct the initial state by having access to any two of them. So it's truly like delocalized. And by the way, this is like a realization of this three-party quantum secret sharing code. But anyway, the point is that because of this resource entanglement, we do not need to touch M3. So this interaction V12 is happening here. So it's no causality violations and so on happening. Now, I think it's interesting to mention that this kind of entanglement-assisted quantum error correction appears in the black hole information loss problem. Namely, this is essentially how the so-called Hayden-Preskill thought experiment works. In their case, instead of these EPR pairs, what they have is entanglement between black hole and the early part of the Hawking radiation. And then what they say is that you throw a diary into the black hole, but just a little bit of interaction, and then already this quantum state is delocalized over all the systems. And so on. So yeah, it's the same mechanism. But anyway, in our context, we just use this nice entanglement a little bit in the past and a little bit in the future, and then delocalize it over M1, M2, M3. Now, so what it does is that somehow by utilizing this resource entanglement in a clever way, we can encode C1, C2, C3 information into quantum error correcting code, delocalized over M1, M2, M3. Okay. Now, before talking about interactions, let me first talk about decoding because it's easier. Now, decoding is possible because, as I said, having access to any two of the points you can reconstruct the information. So C1 information can be decoded from M1 and M2, so it can be revealed from M1, R1, but it can be also revealed from R2 because R2 has access to M2 and M3 and so on. Right? So because of this decoding properties, quantum error correction properties, this version of the code can realize a version of the problem of the so-called summoning, where you have input state in the Psi 1, then 2 and 3 has a classical bit of information which essentially tells 1 to which output points it should go. And the point is, like, by choosing the decoding strategy, it's essentially you can guide this input to any output point. Okay, then finally, let me talk about interactions. So as I mentioned, the interaction should be happening here. Okay, so M1, M2, M3. So then what we should do is we should apply logical operator on these points. But you can't apply arbitrary logical operator because these M1, M2, M3 are separated spatially. So what it should do is that we should think that there is a quantum error correcting code encoded. So Psi1 is encoded over these three sites. Psi2 encoded into these three sites. Psi3 into these three sites. And what we can do is transversal operators, V1 times V2 times V3. So in other words, gate looking like this one, like superposition of the like these things is not possible. Only like a short depth transversal logical operator can be implemented in this case, or like a factorized logical operators only. And then so now then the problem is really reduced to a quantum error correcting problem. That is, we need to come up with nice quantum error correcting code which can implement nice sets of transversal logical operators. And then, but in this context, actually, you can easily show that there is a nice quantum error correcting code which has, let's say, essentially arbitrary Clifford gate as a transversal operator. So we can construct a protocol where you can apply arbitrary Clifford operations among these three input points. And it's actually, this can be achieved, it's pretty easily by applying random Clifford. So it's actually pretty simple thing for qubit case. And for qubit case, you need to rely a little bit on a little bit more complicated thing, but yeah. Another class of nice interactions we can implement is the phase gate. Phase gate just add a phase. And then so far what we found is that we can do any quadratic phase gate. By quadratic means like it's written like this form. This kind of gate you can do very easily. But at this moment, we do not know how to do such a triple, like third degree gate. And this difficulty is actually related to a well-known problem in quantum error correction, because such a gate typically belongs to the third level of the Clifford hierarchy, which is actually not the Clifford operator. So Clifford operator is in the second level, but it's higher. So you need a more complicated transversal logical gate, but quantum code with higher level of the Clifford hierarchy tends to have like less fault tolerance. So that is really the challenge. So at this moment, I do not know how to do this kind of gate. But, but there are nice gates you can do. So we can implement.
The goal is to do it with like a linear amount of entanglement?
Yeah, so all of these I mentioned, it's a Clifford and the phase gate. So for Clifford, I can do with linear amount of entanglement. And then phase gate, it depends on how precise your angle of the phase. So this, so here I put this way, but there is a proportionality constant. So like smallest angle I want to rotate, then the resource typically depends on the,
on the precision.
Precision, but I forgot that precise expression, but usually, I think it's the dependence is only logarithmic in the precision, so it's not about I think, but for other gates it's still not known. Okay, but since I talked about transversal logical gate and I talked about a little bit about whether the logical operator must be complex or complicated or not, so I want to talk a little bit about transversal logical gate. So, okay, let's see. So I have constructed some, I have presented some protocol of how to induce interactions among these three particles by using transversal logical operator, like Clifford gate and so on. And then naively looking at this problem, it seems to make sense because these three particles come together and then they are sitting on, when they collide, they are sitting on this time slice. Then this is a very short period of time you are allowed to do something. And then it may appear that the interaction occurs in this small time slice. So then in the boundary quantum mechanics or conformal field theory, naively thinking, we would think that maybe you have Hamiltonian of the CFT, but you add some perturbation time which induce this kind of interaction nicely. That would be the thing. And then, but then this would imply that the logical operation is coming from this interaction term, right? This perturbation term. So logical operation should be something short depth or delta t depth. So this observation seems to imply that the interactions are all coming from short depths or transversal logical operators. But on the other hand, transversal logical operators are not consistent with tensor network picture. As I mentioned that the tensor networks are constructed from random tensors, and then therefore the logical operator at the center of the bulk tends to be very, very complex on the boundary. Right? It doesn't look like transversal logical operator. And also, as you may know, that the various no-go result for transversal gates in quantum error corrections are known, and then the restriction I mentioned about Clifford hierarchy, third level, and so on, is actually one aspect of this constraint. So then this makes us wonder whether our protocol using transversal logical operators is actually good or not. Is it really like the right way to approach this problem or not? In fact, as I briefly mentioned, that there is a kind of no-go argument for transversal logical gate from a more like a causality viewpoint. As I mentioned that if phi operator on the bulk corresponds to some simple, by simple, I mean that you can implement this operator in an order one depth quantum circuit like this form. Then if this corresponds to a simple boundary operator, then this would mean that this phi operator can be implemented in order one time on the boundary. But this would mean that you can send the signal instantaneously from the boundary to the bulk center. So it seems to be violating the causality or space-time that specify this ADS CFT correspondence. Therefore, yes?
Why can you send the signal?
Oh, it's just because this point and this point are separated.
No, but...
Yeah, sure.
Why can you send the signal this way?
Why?
Well, if you could do it in order one, then you can instantaneously signal to the bulk.
Right. But that's something we probably do not want. If we want to consider a situation where this quantum error correction corresponds to this space-time.
But are there two different theories? And how? Why would something in one mean signaling in the other?
Oh, I see. So the way we tend to think about ADS-CFT correspondence is like how can I say? So of course there is a space-time here, and then there is a distance, and so on. And so then this point and this point are different. So when you want to send a signal from this point to this point, it takes a time, specify this length and so on.
Sure.
But this idea usually extends over to the asymptotic boundary in a sense that if you perturb the asymptotic boundary like this point by applying some local operator here, it usually sends a signal in a local way in a sense that there is an excitation here and it propagates to the center of the ball. But it never get teleported in a sense like it's causal in a sense that it should propagate on this geometry.
Mm-hmm.
So for because of that, whatever you do on the boundary, it shouldn't send a signal to the someone. It's causally separated. That is what I mean. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I think the more. I think this viewpoint may goes a little bit beyond the original ADS-CFT context, but I think the useful analogy is to think that there are like a bunch of experimentalists sitting on the boundary. Then they have like knobs and the probes and so on, and they are doing experiment and they can change some field intensities and so on. And then these actions send a perturbation to the center of the bulk and it changes the situations on the on the bulk. So then in this setup, you can view all the things as a whole system. It's not like one theory here and one theory here, but they are in one setting. And then this is, I think, a more natural from quantum error correction viewpoint, because in quantum error correction, it's essentially, this is like encoding qubits, and then this is the physical system, but as a whole, this is like just a choice state of the quantum error correcting code. So with this kind of viewpoint, you can imagine the whole system setup. Then whatever you do here, it should obey the causal constraint specify this space time.
So this implementation should then take n time or something?
Yes,
in order
yes.
To not have this contradiction.
Right.
Just to say,
not
only about 5 minutes.
Yes. And I have only one or two more. So this operator should be more complex.
Sorry, Ben. I just want to push back a bit what you're saying in this slide. So introducing the Harlow-Urey thing. But that requires that the individual operators in the tensor factor apply each individually, in the code space. But But when you describe the bulk in terms of local degrees of freedom, you're restricting to an additional code space, allow for like variations in the gauge degrees of freedom, and there the Harlow-Urey, if you do that, then it's no longer true that when you apply a local operator, you're going to stay within that more restricted code subspace.
Yeah, so
that's for example why you can do time evolution on the boundary and that instantaneously affects the qubit to the middle.
How do you do that? I just don't.
I mean, it is true, right? If I apply a very short time evolution in the boundary, that's like a transversal gate if I don't allow too much time to pass because.
Yeah. So like if there is a transversal logical gate, then by using that, I can send a signal instantaneously to the center. That is a statement, right? So then, but if we further assume that this causal structure is varied, in a sense that everything we do here is in the semi-classical regimes and so on, then we should respect this causality. So then, that implies that this operator shouldn't be written as a transversal logical operator. But that could be wrong if you do that. It's a logical gate, and there is a strong back reaction to the geometry. And of course, that will be the case. But
I don't know. I mean, to me, the Hamiltonian is just a direct example of there is a transversal logical.
But Hamiltonian doesn't do anything, right?
No, it evolves the center of the bulk.
I mean, the point is that the time clock here and clock here are taking at a very different light.
That's fine. You can still get a very strong interaction in the ball.
But like you can't add a strong interaction on the boundary in a way that it violates the causality of the boundary space. I mean, that she is finite.
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to violate causality because you're not. Yeah, you don't actually have to wait for the signal to propagate from the boundary to the ball.
Yeah. So So honestly, I mean, this might be a logical possibility. There could be some supraluminal signaling in this setting. That might be possible, but I would think that I would first try to avoid that, probably, and then resolve everything. And then maybe there are some mechanism to do that. But I don't think like Hamiltonian would be an example. That's simply because the clocks are ticking at a different rate. So.
It's enough to get the non-local computation of it. So.
Yeah. Anyway, so then I just want to mention. So I think it's nice to revisit the protocol. Is it transversal? And then you may say that it's yes and no in a sense that yes, we did something here transversally, but the point is that we needed some careful preparation on the input points C1, C2, C3. Right, so we needed to a little bit shuffle these input states and then prepare into some. So this process, even though it may look transversal, this is a dynamical process which actually involves some quantum operation here in this. So for this reason, it seems to me that it's like a transversal operation, but in a more like a space-time sense, that is we have done something transversally in this C1, C2, C3, M1, M2, M3. And I believe this is consistent with a concrete recipe of a certain version of the concrete recipe of writing down the bulk operator by using the so-called HKLL reconstruction. But anyway, so. But it seems to me that constructing a transversal gate in kind of this way is really, I think, a very important problem. And because this higher order phase gate and so on, I only see in the quantum error correction context. So it would be, I think, interesting to think about this kind of directions. OK, so let me just conclude with some open problems. And so as I mentioned that, so it's right now there are only three. And like, already, we can do only quadratic gate, but in the case where you have m inputs, we should be able to do mth order gate. And then, but unfortunately, this requires us to go to the mth level of the Clifford hierarchy. Usually, it's less fault tolerant, and then usually, it's inversely proportional to m. So we need to really come up with some nice dynamical encoding strategy. And other thing is like we have found nice 3-in-3-out entanglement-assisted quantum error correction protocol. Is there any applications for the cryptography context? Also, I started feeling like it's probably interesting to think about transversal logical operator in a space-time sense, not only in space. And then, but finally, I think we should really try to understand this holographic task paradigm in the language of the actual quantum mechanical system, preferably for actual CFT, but even like a toy model, it will be interesting. Okay, so let me thank with this summary of our protocol. Okay, thank you very much.
Questions. Does this give you a way to actually construct new quantum error correcting codes?
I think it's more fair to say that ADS CFT correspondence is challenging us to come up with maybe it can be done with known code, but I really don't think like a simple use of a stabilizer code would give us like this. So if you increase the number of input, then right now you have three layers, for four, then four layers. So it will be like a more dynamical process where you encode and apply, then, yeah.
Okay.
Usually this higher degree phase gate code are usually very difficult to encode. So if with this kind of simple strategy, actually we don't have enough time, but I think there should be a way to avoid this kind of thing. Otherwise, this interaction is not possible.
Okay.
Maybe I can ask a question. In that picture, if 1, 1, 2, and 3 are qubits, is there any bound on, any theoretical bound on how complex the QCC
could be?
Bound on dimensions of the spaces?
So, yeah, we usually really don't want to perturb the system too much. So, I think everything should be done in a more like a these dimensions should be much, much less than the just 1 over g newton, yeah, which is
okay,
a very big number.
Sure.
But yeah, so I think the point is like these interactions are happening at the level of a matter field. So these things, I believe that these things should be done. Well, do I believe? Yeah, that's. I think it's safe to say that yeah, these interactions, this kind of thing should be happening at the level where I can still treat them as a matter field. If they become too big, then I can't treat it as a small perturbation to the geometry. It's not like something is sitting on the background geometry, but itself becomes too big.
Okay, well, there are no more questions immediately. Let's thank Penny again.